I work at Bell Union, this record label that is in its 26th year. And this is Simon Raymond, the founder and man behind the curtain, or on the stage in this instance, very visible. And today we're going to talk about the history of Bell Union.
Okay, but before we do that, that's the first time I've ever walked on the stage to Destiny's Child, so that's a first. But I must tell you a little bit about Annika, because you'll all be wondering who Annika is. Do you remember what year you started? Was it 2010?
Yeah.
So Annika's been at the label 13 years. And what age were you when you started working there?
Just turned 20.
Okay, so I think I met you a couple of years before that.
Yeah.
And I used to notice Annika at every Bell Union gig that I would go to, because there's only about 20 people at the shows. So you'd always see the same people every week. And I kept seeing Annika. And I think the first time I spoke to you was at End of the Road, was it?
Yeah, it could have been.
The festival that Lauren was talking about earlier. And I was like, you're always at our shows. Like, I thought I should come and say hello. And we started talking. And after about half an hour, I was like, wow, she's a really fantastic person. You know, she's like an artist. She's promoting shows. She's doing all sorts of cool stuff. She'd be brilliant to have at Bell Union. So after a few more meetings, I said to her, I hope you don't mind me asking. I know you're sort of really busy with all your different projects, but you know, might you like to come and work at the label? And she was like, "No, thanks."
Did I say no? Yeah. So I actually don't remember saying.
You said, "I'm just a bit too busy with all my projects." I was so crestfallen. I was like, "Oh, okay. Maybe you could carry on doing all your things, but just sit in my office and help me out with one or two things." And you were like, yeah, I suppose I could do that. And that's Annika.
Well, yeah, that's me. Enough about me, though. Today we're here to talk about Simon and Bell Union. And you can read the history of Bell Union and everything online. And I kind of already know about that, so it's not super interesting for me. So I thought maybe we'd do like a different kind of interview. And the format for the interview, I was thinking, would be to go through your life from like childhood to now and talk about like music, because everyone's tastes change and evolve, and everyone has like their first musical memories of like sitting in the car and listening to a certain song or learning to play a song on a certain instrument. Like, do you remember the first song, for example, that you played on the bass? Did you learn through playing?
Yes, I do remember that. I can tell you that story. So there was a punk band called The Vibrators, who were a sort of London band around the, I suppose, 76, something like that. And I would have been 14. My brother was friends with Pat Collier, who was the bassist of the band. And I can't remember why he bought a bass off him, or he swapped it for a guitar or something. Came back with a bass. He didn't like playing the bass, so he gave it to me for a birthday present. And Never Mind the Bollocks by the Sex Pistols had just come out. And I thought, okay, maybe I'll have a little go. I was already like musical. I'd had violin lessons when I was a kid.
What were you playing, like classical music?
Yeah, I was just at school doing that thing. You know, when you sort of go to school, well, you won't know, but in the 70s, you went to school, you'd come home with an instrument and, you know, you'd try it out at home. I was given the oboe and I came home and just made the most unholy noise with it. And I could see the look on my parents' face, because my dad's quite a famous musician, and I could tell how disappointed he was at the noise that was coming out of the oboe. So I went back to school the next day and I was like, no, I'm not going to be an oboist. So they gave me a violin and I tried that, and the noise was also pretty terrible, but I persevered and became quite successful on the violin. But anyway, bass was what I kind of fell in love with. Playing along to Never Mind the Bollocks, I learnt the whole album in about half an hour in my room. And that was really the beginning of this magical little journey, yeah.
And were you just learning from ear, just playing along to the music? Wow.
Yeah.
And was there other kinds of music in the house at the time? Like, what was... Because obviously your dad Simon's dad was Ivor Raymond, who wrote and arranged a lot of music that you will be familiar with. I imagine that he was always playing music, or...
Yeah, he's either playing stuff or away from home a lot, you know. He wrote a lot of big hits for Dusty Springfield, and he did arrangements for the Walker Brothers and David Bowie. And, you know, he was a big achiever in the music business. But, of course, when you're 14-year-old snotty punk, you know, you're not really kind of thinking your dad's amazing. I only realised how amazing he was after he passed away very young. So, yeah, in the house, my brother is older, so he's listening to... what I thought was hideous stuff, like Little Feet and Dylan and the Stones. I couldn't stand any of that kind of music when I was a snotty punk. Then my sisters, who are a bit younger, were all listening to like the Beatles and the Beach Boys and stuff like that, which I, you know, you sing along to that stuff because it's pop music, and I sort of enjoyed it. I remember Good Vibrations, hearing that for the first time, being kind of astounded by the harmonics, the harmonies. It was pretty mind-blowing. But really, the light bulb moment was punk, yeah. You know, and obviously going to see bands in 76, 77, like The Clash, The Slits, Wire, Buzzcocks. Being in London in that period, you know, really it was is still, for me, the most influential period in music that I can think of. It sort of fanned the flames, you know. Yeah.
Can you set the scene a bit? Like, what was it like seeing live music in London back then? Because obviously it's so different now, and like the community and a lot of the venues have closed, and it's just a completely different music landscape.
Yeah, I mean, I still get as much excitement about going to see small bands in small venues that I did back then. But certainly, you know, being in London during that period and just... I mean, looking back, I saw, you know, seeing Joy Division, and just Television, Talking Heads, Blondie, Patti Smith, you know, just like a list of incredible bands that would play. And I worked in a record shop. My very first job was working at the Beggars Banquet record shop, which is another catalyst moment, because getting that job, I used to go in there all the time, right? So I would buy all my little punk singles in the Beggars Banquet shop. It was in South Kensington, and I was staying in a bedsit in Earls Court, which is just in the centre of town. And I would go in there every day with my best friend Stan. And after about 6 months, the owner, I don't think he was annoyed that I was going in there all the time, but he was like, why don't you just come and work here? You know as much about it as I do. So I started working there initially as a Saturday job, and then I got a full-time job there. And that shop really is why I'm here, actually, because the record shop was on the ground floor, and you had to walk through the record shop to get upstairs to where the record labels were housed. Beggars, 4AD, Situation 2, were the three independent labels that were upstairs. You know, very, very in the very early days of that time. So, you know, I met everyone that's become important in my life in that shop. So I have to cite that as a massive part of who I am.
And what kind of music? I feel like everyone who works at record shops is introduced to new music and meets musicians coming through the door. Is there anything that stands out in particular
The Cocteau Twins, and that's how I met them. Actually, was when I would have been like 19, I think, and I got in early one day and with Steve, the owner, and we were just unpacking some boxes, and then there was a knock on the window. It's a tiny little shop, you know, it's like the tiny. There was a knock on the window, and I went to the door, and there were three very peculiar looking people at the door. And I sort of said, I'm sorry, we're not open till 10. Well, they were there like 9 o'clock in the morning or something. And then they were here to deliver a cassette of their debut album to Ivo Watts Russell, who was the founder and owner of 4AD Records. So I was like, oh, cool, he's not in yet, you know, because the labels don't tend to get in till at least 10, 30, 11. But I'll give it to him. If you want to come back then. And they were like, no, we have to go. We have to catch a bus back to Scotland, where they were from. So weirdly, 2 years later, I'm in the band. So these funny little things happen to me, and I don't really know why they. I think if you're just in a place where good stuff is happening, you know, I'm sure you'll find that in the music business. If you're just in a place a lot, and you have an energy about you that's open, which I always have done, you know, I'm always like open to things. I never wanted to be in the Cocteau Twins. That wasn't an aim of mine, but it just sort of happened really, really naturally. They liked my other little band that was signed to Situation 2 that was upstairs. They were obviously signed to 4AD. We were all friends. Everyone on the label was friends with everyone in the shop. And it was just a very incestuous little community, you know. But a very, very beautiful time. And I think back to it a lot.
And when you think of that time, did you have any awareness or like vision for your future being someone that lived a life of music?
And
I guess for like it's when you're that age, you don't necessarily think about like what you're going
to
be
doing. No, but you're loving every second of it, and you're thinking, well, I want, you know, I'd like to get like this to go on as long as possible. You know, you, as you say, when you're young, you're not really thinking much beyond the next day. So, I mean, obviously, starting off on the little label, putting out a couple of singles with my very first band, was huge. I mean, getting the single of the week in the NME and Sounds, which was the other music paper at the time, I was, like, ready to give up, quit the music business then, because I thought it was probably never going to get better than this. Two of my favourite writers, Paul Morley, who wrote for the NME, and in Sounds, the writer was a guy called Dave McCulloch, also another brilliant writer. So seeing them write about my little band was like phenomenally exciting. And the band unfortunately didn't really continue very long. But I wanted to carry on playing. I'd really enjoyed the experience. And Robin and Liz from Cocteau's had split with the bass player from the band. And we ended up in a recording studio by accident one day. I had a part-time job working in an 8-track studio in Camden on the weekends. And the owners had gone away. And I'd said to Robin and Liz, if you guys want to come to the studio and use the studio while the owners are away, it's all yours. I'll let you in and you can crack on, you know. And they turned up. And then Robin just looked at me and was like, okay, so what do you want to do? And I was like, what do you mean? I'm just here to help you. I was going to make the tea. And he said, no, come on, let's write a song together. So I was like, what? Weird. I can't write songs just like that off the cuff. But we did. We wrote a song in like about 20 minutes. Liz went out to get chips. And when she came back, we'd written this lovely piece of music together. I played the bass, he played the guitar. We'd set up drum beat going. And right there, in that half an hour, we sort of set the template for exactly how we would record our music for the next however many years we did it, 14 years. It was just all improvised. It was all, we'd always tell the record label we had an album ready to go and we had nothing. We never demoed anything. We never went in the studio in advance. We just went in and pressed record and just sort of made shit up basically, and that was very good fun. Terrifying sometimes, especially when your label is sort of, you know, waiting for the record and you're not sure what you're going to give them.
That's crazy.
It is crazy. I mean, now I've been doing this for so long, I realize how crazy it is, but at the time it seemed quite normal. But obviously talking to other bands since, most people like sit at home with the guitar and work the chords out and think of a melody to sit on the top, and it's all, you know, very planned out. We just literally winged the whole thing, which is probably why some of our records aren't very good, because they, you know, they're very up and down. You know, some have some great moments on it, and others, you know, when you're winging it completely, it's a big...
Were you not tempted to go back and, you know, like the sort of age-old trope of, like, never knowing when to finish? Were you never tempted to, like, keep going back and tweaking?
Oh, well, the labels never really had the budget to allow you to tweak. I think the first record cost £900, I think. And then, once we'd worked out that we couldn't work with engineers or producers because we were just too shy and too weird and that they didn't really understand what we were trying to get. And once we then started investing all the little money we did make in bits of equipment, you know, tape machines, reverbs and pedals and all that kind of stuff, and building up our arsenal of gear, that's when we started to sort of stumble upon the right sound. And then by the time, I suppose 1985 was the first time we actually had a key to our own studio. We built a studio in this little industrial unit in North Acton, in North London. And that was where we made the album The Moon and the Melodies with the minimal pianist Harold Budd. And that's where we made Bluebell Knoll in 1988. And then we moved to a bigger studio, a place in Richmond, which was owned by Pete Townsend of The Who, which was kind of crazy. He was our landlord for 10 years. And that's where we made Heaven in Las Vegas. So once we sort of established ourselves, we were able to hone our craft better, spend more time on the music, not rush it so much. In the early days, you know, 900 quid's not going to get you very far. We had 2 weeks to make Treasure, I think, which came out in 1984. And then I think we did mix, and that took another week to mix somewhere else, but yeah.
And who else were the 4AD bands at the time? Were you sort of the big one, I guess?
Dead Can Dance were a pretty big band. Just after us came like he started signing American bands like the Pixies and Throwing Muses. But prior to that, 4AD, oh gosh, my memory's so terrible. The Wolfgang Press. I think Bauhaus were on 4AD for a while, or maybe that was Beggars. Yeah, I'll come back to you on that.
And you toured a lot?
Yes, we did tour a lot. I mean, people say, the band, you know, Crocterton's never really toured much, we did tour a lot. I think we probably did about 200 shows in my time in the band. Initially, our tour, I don't think we were very good live, because it was, you know, it was very static. You know, we just sort of stood there staring at our pedals and our shoes, and Liz was, the most animated she got was like, you know, beating her chest. I don't think she was even aware she was doing it. She was just so terrified. I have always found playing live utterly perplexing. I don't enjoy it really at all, but I enjoy all the things that go along with it, like the drugs. No, I'm just kidding.
I guess the way you were creating the music was so improvised and spontaneous and freeing, then suddenly performing it to an audience takes away all of those elements, and you have to play what
the same
you wrote.
Thing. Yeah, and we were very restricted technically. We weren't very good musicians. That's that. But also, we had a tape machine as our drummer, so we had like a reel-to-reel machine on the back of the stage. With the drums, and so every night you're playing the same set. You know, I would play my bass, Robin would play his guitar, and Liz would sing, and we did that for several years before we stumbled upon the very original idea of getting some extra people in to help us. And that's, I think we got a little bit better once we had a drummer. Yeah.
Are there some lessons you learned along the way in your time releasing music with 4AD that you think then...
Oh.
Came on to
useful.
Influence how Bella Union came to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like it's a life lesson, isn't it? That the things you learn the most from are usually the things that go worst. And there were a lot of listen. The 4AD is an amazing label. Ivor was an incredible person, but there is no doubt that we did fall out over things. Artwork, 4AD was, you know, which is what makes them brilliant, is that they had this their art department that was very unique. Their sleeves are super original and different, but sort of, you know, the bands kind of had to fit into that aesthetic. And if your aesthetic is, you don't really feel that aesthetic is defining you how you want to be portrayed, it can cause some conflict. And we definitely didn't deal with conflict very well with our record label. We didn't. We fell out with them over things, which in hindsight I wish we hadn't. But you know, you can't go back in time and change the past. We did fall out with them, and about money. We really fell out with them badly over money. because we were doing incredibly well of selling, you know, hundreds of thousands of records, but we were all still on the dole, you know, and earning very, very, very little. And, you know, it's funny listening to the panels earlier about how little money there is to be made from streaming. Well, nothing's really changed, you know, even when, even, you know, when we were in a physical retail market, the bands are still broke. So we fell out with them over money, and then we did eventually leave. So I think, you know, when you get round to having your own record label, you can't not be affected by the things that you've learned along the way. And, okay, I definitely wouldn't want to do it that way. I don't want to sign a band and then fall out with them over money. That just seems wrong and pointless. So I think it sort of teaches you things, but it's never immediate. You need to soak this stuff in. And I think with the record label, we never intended to have a record label to release other people's music. That was never on the cards.
So Bella Union was founded in 1997, which was right after you left 4AD, or...?
No, so we left 4AD just after Heaven Las Vegas, which came out in 91. We toured around a lot, and that was very much our most successful record. And then we sort of were in the middle of falling out badly with the label, and we made the very foolish decision to sign with a major, with Universal. It was a label called Fontana, which was part of Universal. It seemed the right decision at the time.
Why?
Okay, so if you just put yourself in our shoes, we'd been like super friendly and super close with the boss of this record label. He was like our mate. And he's influenced me in so many ways. Ivo Watts Russell, you know, he took us to see Tarkovsky films. And, you know, he's like, he's culturally very smart man. And we all looked up to him and respected him. So when we fell out with him, it was pretty painful. So we thought, okay, well, if we're going to work with anyone else in the business, and we did get taken out to lunch by a lot of big labels, we could have signed with a bunch of them, but we went for the money because we just thought we don't want a relationship with our record label. We want to be left alone. Give us the money, we can buy our own gear, hibernate in our studio, make beautiful music we make, and then put it out, and it'll be fine, won't it? Yeah, that was a massively naive thing to do, because, you know, no one gives you a ton of money and then expects you to sit on your ass doing nothing, which is kind of what we thought would happen.
Did they end up becoming like more involved and asking for more?
They
than
tried.
4AD was,
they yeah. tried, and that really didn't go down well. Yeah. We ended up actually just locking the studio and not letting them in. They would want to come around all the time and just, can we listen to the album? We're like, no. We never would play anything to anyone until the record was finished. It didn't seem right because it needed to be mixed to be understood. Yeah. I mean, even the 4AD never asked to come and listen to the records. They would just wait until we gave it them. So we definitely made a massive mistake in signing with the major. And within 3 months, I think, from being a real priority for them, once they realized how annoying we were, we were just not a priority anymore. You couldn't even get through on the phone, you know. So that was a very, very bad mistake. And then we decided to set up... We put out two albums through Universal, and we decided to set up our own label so we didn't have to deal with that bullshit. So we did, and then the band broke up. So it's like... Lots of things happened for the band to break up. It wasn't just the Universal thing. It was like drug problems and relationship problems. And it kind of all came to a head with, the second record and falling out with the label so badly. So let's start our own label. We can put out our own music. We've got this beautiful studio on the river in by the Thames. It's like idyllic. We love being here. We can do collaborations. We can put solo records out. We can do this all on our own cool label, and that's what happened. We got a letterhead made and brochure made for the studio and a logo, and then Liz called me up and said, "I just can't do this anymore. I just can't be in a band with someone that I'm not feeling close to anymore."
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, if you think about it, they broke up in 1992, And we didn't actually break up as a band until 1997. So that's 5 years of dealing with a lot of emotional drama every day.
Must have been difficult for you, sort of being the third member of this.
I mean, I just got on with it, you know, because I'm that kind of guy. I just get on with things. But I think in hindsight, I mean, it ruined my marriage because I had to spend so much time in rehab with the two of them for different reasons. In America, like dealing with stuff and then dealing with my own stuff, and just the whole thing was just such a drama. And I know bands, you know, bands can be a drama, and that's cool, but it definitely took its toll. So I'm just amazed that we carried on for 5 years, yeah. To be honest. So when she called, I was disappointed, of course, because I think what kept us together was actually that we loved our band so much.
Yeah.
We loved the music we made so much, and that was really it.
Yeah.
And once she called and said it's over, I think I grasped onto Bella Union as something to do, so I didn't have to think about how terrible not having a band was, yeah, anymore. So I just threw myself into the label, and I didn't have a fucking clue what I was doing. You know, some would say I still don't, but I just threw myself into it.
Yeah.
And just started signing some bands, and I think the first band we signed was Dirty Three, Warren Ellis, you know, who's pretty cool, and John Grant, the band The Czars, and just slowly but surely, I think we were absolutely rubbish at running a label for 4 or 5 years, made so many mistakes. But you know, it's like I said before, you have to make mistakes to learn how to move on and do things better.
I'm curious, what were some of the early initial Bella Union mistakes?
Well, you would
have still been young, early 30s, right? And like, but a lot of experience, yeah, in the music world,
just remember that we didn't like record labels. We didn't like them. We fell out with the two that we were on. So running one seemed like quite a responsibility, but at the same time it's like, well, as long as we don't do it that way, we should be fine. But you know, anyone that's done this as a job, it's just like, it's complicated, it's difficult. And I think we definitely made some mistakes with, you know, wrong distributor or wrong press people, or you know, but then you get it wrong once and you make sure you don't get it wrong again.
Did you have any friends that worked at record labels, or any like I think of my life now, and I know loads of people that, I mean, like, it's pretty easy to set up a record label now, not to be successful, but like anyone can set up a record label, and we have this like pool of information that we can all share and knowledge that we can get from each other. And there's things like this, I suppose, where you go and you just meet a bunch of people.
There was nothing like this. Yeah. No, there really wasn't. Well, if there was, I wasn't aware of it. We were pretty antisocial, if I'm honest. We just had our own studio and we just shut the door and locked the rest of the world out. Maybe that's partly why the music is like it is, because it's sort of almost private, you know? So no, we had no friends in the music business, really. So it's always been a bit of a learning curve.
It's kind of crazy to imagine you being like so antisocial, because I feel like in this age and this like Bella Union that I know, it's all about people and relationships and getting to know each other, and it's not about hiding yourself away, it's about being present.
Yes, that's very, very true. But I think, you know, we're never always going to be the same, and it would be tragic if I was still the same miserable, sullen, sulky little prick that I was back then. So, you know, I think I probably learned from some very harsh lessons. And also, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. The collaborative part and is what makes it fun. And having great relationships with your artists is what makes it fun. So we've been, to you and me and everyone in my team, we've been trying to get to that position where... Because what I do remember is someone saying to me, oh, don't be friends with your band. You can't mix business and pleasure. And I always found that really weird. I was like, I don't see why not. I mean, if you're not ripping them off and you're nice to them and they're nice to you, there's no reason why you can't be friends. So I've always sort of tried to get on well with the bands. And I think if you look at the artists that we've signed, you know, from the first Beach House record in 2006, still working with them, whatever it is, like 18 years later. Same with Father John Misty, same with John Grant. You know, we do stick with our bands and they with us, which it probably tells you that we're getting it right slightly more than we're getting it wrong, which is, you know, as some of the people mentioned on previous panels, is probably why we're all here, because you just get away with it slightly more than you know when you lose.
And some of those artists you've mentioned, like Warren Ellis, John Grant, they are the artists that are still with us today. Like, it's crazy that we've been able to, like, go on those journeys together for so long.
It is.
What was it like hating record labels and then being the record label?
It's fine. I mean, sometimes I've struggled with the sitting on the fence bit and... you know, getting that balance between being the label person and being the artist person. But I think I worked it out, you know, maybe a few years into the label when I realized that I can't have a conversation about music from any other perspective than from the artists, because that's what I feel. You know, I always look at their point of view. And even though some business people might be sitting around going, yes, but blah, 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 I'm like, yeah, but that's not cool, or that's not the way to do it. So I've always erred on the side of the artist's standpoint, which is probably why I'm broke. Yeah, that must be it.
I mean, I can testify, I've only ever seen you have this artist mindset. And I think that's one of the reasons, at least from where I sit, why I think Bella Union's a really special label, is because the culture that Simon has created for us as his team and with our roster of artists is that he is an artist and he wants the label to be artist friendly. And so for us as employees, there's quite a lot of freedom creatively, and for us to have our own relationships with the artists and for the artists. Like, we're not the kind of label that will never force you to let us into your studio while you're making the album, and we'll never force you to have your artwork a certain way. We might say, not so sure about that, but I don't think we've ever forced anyone to do anything.
No, I mean, no, that's true. I mean, I suppose I have looked back at some records that we've released where, you know, it's maybe 13 songs that maybe should have been 12 or 11.
Or 24 songs that should have been 10.
Yeah, exactly. There are times where someone says, you know, what do you think? And I'll say what I think, and then they'll go and do whatever they want anyway. But that you know, that's, you have to take the rough with the smooth. You can't have it both ways. So I'm like, okay, you do it your way, but let's see how well it does. And of course, that is my risk, because I've got to press that double album that should have been a single album. We've been there, right? You know, you go down that road. Maybe the next time round, you sort of say, look, it didn't really go that well, because a double album, it's an hour and 20 minutes. People don't have that long to listen to music anymore. They're over it with it in 30 seconds, you know, so you've got to get to the point a bit quicker. But that's not really my job as the label person. My job is to allow people to, our job is to allow people the space, the freedom to express themselves the way they want. And yeah, you're not going to get every record right. And I also think that's a big part of making music, is it's not having ever, it doesn't have, all have to be 10 tracks long and 36 minutes long. You know, I just think people need, in this world especially, because it's so fucked up and there's no right way of making a living out of it, or, you know what I mean? You just got to let people do what they want to do. And we support our artists. If we love them, you know, they can make a 90-minute one-track album if they want.
Yeah.
It's not very likely.
I feel like it's wonderful working at a label that is so diverse musically. Have you noticed your music tastes change at all, or grow at all, or like, in, obviously you have, but in what ways? And like, what ways has releasing music changed the way that you listen to music?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think just sort of going back to the punk days. When I worked in Beggar's Shop, I just liked that kind of music, dub and punk. And then when the shop closed down after a year, I went and worked in a dub shop in Shepherd's Bush Market. And then I got a job in Our Price, which was like a chain, you know, it was like, yeah, it's like, I don't know, Tower or one of these kind of chains. And I was a bit older, still kind of just like post-punk and that kind of music. And I think on my first day, the owner of the record shop, the manager of the record shop, this guy called Andy Frayne, who I'm still friends with now. This would be 1982, I guess. We got on really well straight away, but he was into stuff like ECM records, and he was into like modern jazz, and I did not like that stuff at all. Couldn't get my head around it. So after work, he said, "Just like stay behind at work," and he started rolling up some joints and smoking in the shop, which I thought, oh, that's pretty cool, and putting on some records that I would never have normally been into. And I'm sure it wasn't just the smoking, but I, you know, my tastes just suddenly widened in that next week. And then the next month we'd have more sit-ins and lock-ins and just talking about music. And then he'd play me Miles Davis. I mean, I should have known Miles Davis. Most 20-year-olds know Miles Davis, but I didn't really know that much stuff because I was just into my very narrow stuff.
You're a punk kid.
Yeah, I didn't get anything else. So that was amazing, working in a bigger shop with a much bigger selection of music. That was really the sort of the moment where I was like, wow, there's so much amazing stuff out there.
Yeah.
And that, I think, probably helped I think that probably helped me as a musician, yeah. I would say. I mean, not that I turned into Jaco Pastorius, but I definitely helped me as a musician. Traveling around the world with the CD Walkmans and, you know, listening to all these things and Eno records and ambient stuff. Yeah, my taste definitely evolved during the Cocteau's years. And then I think when you have a label, it's very easy to sort of get into a little funnel. Oh, you just do this kind of thing. And I never wanted to do that, but sometimes it just happens by accident. I think we had a sort of period where whenever I read a review, it was like, yeah, Bella Union. Well, first of all, it was Bella Union, the Cocteau Twins boutique label. That really pissed me off. It was true. That's what it was. But I didn't like it because it sort of seemed to diminish the music. Talk about the music, not about the bloke running it. So then we were like an Americana kind of label, which I didn't like either. Not that there's anything wrong with it, and we did have loads of artists in that style. But I sort of, I don't know, it made me more conscious that I needed to look outside of just this small window that I was looking in, you know?
Yeah, I think when I joined the label, there were a lot more American artists on the label than there are now. Like, when in 2010, the artists we were releasing were like Andrew Bird, yeah. Fleet Foxes, Peter Broderick, Laura Veers, Vetiver.
Yeah.
That, and then I'd say now I work on a lot more European artists from the UK, yeah, than previously.
Yeah, that was definitely a conscious thing. I think South by Southwest was obviously really important to me because I think I started going there in 1998, I think. And obviously going to Texas, to Austin, great city, seeing the most incredible bands from all over the world. I mean, South by Southwest does get a bit of a bad press these days, but it's still a brilliant festival. In fact, much better now than it was even a few years ago. It's back to how it sort of used to be back in the early days. So I saw a lot of bands like that, and I was really off British music. I think Britpop killed British music for me. Sorry for anyone out there that likes Blur and Oasis. I don't mind that stuff, but I really hated it at the time, and I didn't like the sort of maleness of it and the sort of laddish culture that it sort of attached itself to. I was not into that. So I think going to America and seeing how brilliant the musicians were, how much better the musicians were, or seemed to be anyway, I just was so off. I couldn't even imagine signing a British band for like, until we signed Lanterns on the Lake. I think that was the first British band I signed ever, maybe. Yeah. And My Latest Novel, maybe.
Yeah, and then there were a few around that period that came, like Zanzanigui, Alessa.
Yeah,
Dark.
Yeah. When that sort of happened, 2005, 6, 7, I started getting back into it, and I felt, oh yeah, so we are learning from America, because I do think there's often a sort of exchange of ideas, and not even consciously. Yeah. I just think that was happening more. And then, well, now we sign bands from wherever. It doesn't matter, does it? Korea. We signed an incredible instrumental band called Jambinai a few years back, and you know, that's a beautiful thing to be able to do.
Yeah. I'm curious, like, do you have any, like, tales of near misses? Like, I know that you do. Artists that got away, and which are the ones that really still stick with you? Or do you just sort of get over it as time goes on?
Remind me of which one?
Well, I'm just thinking of, like, I remember we almost signed Grimes, for example. Or
yes, that would have been good. Well, no.
Or I,
mean,
I could have
no,
signed
actually wouldn't be, because then
Cigarettes After
Elon
Sex,
Musk
you know,
would
like
be
those
on
sorts
lives.
Of things.
Yes, but I'm you just could have signed Cigarettes After Sex.
Or I remember when I used to work in the office. We used to have an office, but we don't have a London office anymore. We were listening to the Sinead O'Connor album to maybe work with.
Yes, there's lots of near misses. I think when you're, you know, meeting people and you're somebody with a musician past, you know, you're gonna meet other cool people, and conversations do come up. And yes, I don't really think about these things very often because I'm more of a sort of today person. Yeah. But Martha Wainwright is one I think we should have probably signed but didn't. I mean, the most beautiful one, which kind of have you to thank for, is working with Patti Smith. I used to get asked questions like when we were on our 10th anniversary, our 15th anniversary, like, who would your dream signing be? And like every time I did that interview, it would be Patti Smith, because I grew up like adoring Patti Smith, not just as a musician, but just as a human being. You know, just wonderful person and beautiful poetry and just such a, I don't know, fantastic person. And now here we are. We work with her, and I just almost like have to pinch myself daily that this job allows. It's not an indulgence. That's the wrong word, but it just. Yes, indulges my passion for music to be able to do these things. And I know how much pleasure that gives you too, and that makes me happy too.
Yeah, last year, the Patti Smith release that we did, it's with a group called Soundwalk Collective, and they do like sort of experimental field recordings. And we released a trilogy of albums and did a box set. And there was an exhibition at the Pompidou, so Simon and I got to meet Patti Smith and Michael Stipe, which I thought was really cool because I also love REM.
Yeah, I mean, just little moments like that. What, we were in the dressing room for like 15 minutes, and I've stood next to Patti Smith a few times in my life, but I've always been a bit too, you know, awestruck to sort of say anything meaningful, so I just generally don't say anything. But she invited us in to her dressing room straight after the show, and she was so beautifully and enthusiastic about the box set, and then Michael Stipe pipes up and says, yes, it's so beautiful, isn't it? Me and Annika just look at each other going, wow, this room is like this big. And we're crowded in it with Michael Stipe and Patti Smith. Absolutely mental. So these beautiful moments are why you get up in the morning. Yeah, for sure.
I'm conscious that maybe other people might have some questions. I don't know if we're set up to do other people's questions, but if we are, maybe. One or two? Does anyone have any, like, burning questions?
I can't see a thing.
No?
Come on, I know this.
Don't be shy.
No? Okay.
Okay, I'll ask you another question then. I have a lot of really wonderful memories of working and meeting people over the years and working on projects, going to shows, going to places around the world and seeing music. I've got my own favourite moments. I don't think I've ever asked you, like, what are your, like, top favourite?
Oh, gosh, this in 26 years, there's so many, but I think, like, I've had to encapsulate, like, what Bella Union means to me. The John Grant story is probably my favourite, because it involves, it isn't just about music, it's about humanity and about humility and suffering and being there for somebody during incredibly difficult times. And the sort of condensed conference version of the story is that John Grant signed to Bella Union in 1998, was one of the first signings that I made. He'd actually sent me his music on a DAT, digital audio tape. Anybody remember those? No, probably not. Too young. And the demos were terrible. Like, but there was something about his voice that was amazing. And I kept writing back to him and saying, I like you, but not the band, I'm not really sure about. And cut long story short, I brought him over to the studio where we had in London. I produced the first two Zaz albums. He made another one back in Denver, and they were critically appreciated, but commercially, yeah, a massive failure. And he was a very fragile kind of person with a lot of issues going on, and he had lost all his confidence, even though I just knew he would get there in the end. It's just trying to keep him going. Well, you know, he went back to New York. He was translating Russian dictionaries from Russian into German. He's like the most amazing linguist you'll ever meet. He speaks about 15 languages completely fluently. So that was how he was making his living. But he was in a mentally very fragile state, and he was actually on a suicide watch in hospital. Now, one of my other bands, a band from Texas called Midlake, who were also friends with John, because when artists signed to Bella Union, we often put them on the same bills, you know, like match them up together, and they'd become very friendly. And when they heard John wasn't well, they called him up and asked him, you know, come to Texas, just get away from New York for a bit, come and live with us, come and work in our studio, we'll help you make a record. You're too great to be, you know, languishing in a hospital bed in New York. Which was a very beautiful, generous act of kindness. And they brought him over to... This is a very long story, I'm sorry about that. They brought him over to Texas. They ended up making the first John Grant album, Queen of Denmark. And there are lots of reasons why, but when it came out, it just hit a nerve with people. He was at that point where he was being very honest. When you sort of like been going through drug problems and you're in that therapy moment where you sort of have to say exactly what is your feeling, because that's part of the recovery process. Well, he was in that mode. So all the interviews, I remember the editor of Mojo is a friend of mine called Phil Alexander. He'd heard the tracks on the record and he'd said, like, it's amazing. Could I do a little 10-minute Q&A with John? And I said, yeah, of course, that'd be amazing. What a great start to the record campaign. And I bumped into him a couple months later, and I said, how did that interview with John go? And he went, yeah, we were on the phone for 4.5 hours. That's John. He's just the person that you end up talking to for 4.5 hours, and he was in that phase of his life. The album came out, did incredibly well, was like album of the month in Mojo, got his solo career off to an incredible start. We're still working with him now. That was 2010. One of the most special people that I've ever met in the world, in not just in music, but you know, it enriches your life when you are involved in something that is so important. It wasn't just about an album coming out of great songs. They are great songs, but it was about helping him on his journey to wherever he needed to get to. And of course, when you're there all the time and you turn up to the shows and you're involved in the career as it moves forward and you see the person, I mean, you would never recognize the person today that he was in 2010. And that ain't that long ago, right? That's like just 13 years ago. You know, he's got his shit together, man, and he's just like in a great, great space. So that actually makes me more happy than whether it sold this many or that many. It's just about that John Grant story is... why I'm glad I did this thing. That's it.
And on that note, which I feel like is a very beautiful note to end on, thank you so much for sharing all of that, Simon, and for employing me and sharing some of these wonderful experiences with me. And yeah, we'll be around if you want to say hello.
Yeah, thanks everybody. Thanks to Matthias. Cheers.